Horror gripped the heart of the World War I soldier as he saw his lifelong friend fall in battle. Caught in a trench with continuous gunfire whizzing over his head, the soldier asked his lieutenant if he might go out into the no man's land between the trenches to bring his fallen comrade back. "You can go," said the lieutenant, "but I don't think it'll be worth it. Your friend is probably dead, and you may throw your life away." The lieutenant's advice didn't matter as the soldier went anyway. Miraculously, he managed to reach his friend, hoist him onto his shoulder, and bring him back to their company's trench. As the two of them tumbled in together to the bottom of the trench, the officer checked the wounded soldier and then looked kindly at his friend. I told you it wouldn't be worth it," he said. "Your friend is dead and you're mortally wounded." "It was worth it, though, sir," said the soldier. "What do you mean, worth it?" responded the lieutenant. "Your friend is dead." "Yes, sir," the private answered, "but it was worth it because when I got to him, he was still alive, and I had the satisfaction of hearing him saying, 'Jim, I knew you'd come.'" From the Reader's Digest, there's a story a guy submitted. He said, "After my wife of 44 years died, I didn't feel the urge to socialize, but that didn't stop my friend, Tony, from inviting me to join a group of guys who got together every Thursday for dinner. I told him I wasn't ready. He called again the next week, and again I said no. He kept calling every week," he said. "And finally, I said, 'I will go. Anything to keep you from calling me again next week.'" "It had been 6 years now since my wife died, and thanks to Tony, I've been going out to dinner every week with the new gang we've dubbed Romeo, Retired Old Men Eating Out." And the final story here is, "My fiancé walked out on me," a guy wrote the Reader's Digest. "My fiancé walked out on me 3 days before our wedding. Now every year on the anniversary of the day I would have been married, my best friend texts me a hilarious picture reminding me I dodged a bullet. His humor makes the day a little easier." You might be guessing what the subject is today. We're talking about friendship. One of the things that becomes evident the longer you live is that the ups and downs, even at a young age, you can begin to experience this turbulence of life. A child can experience illness, you can move, divorce, death of loved one, or even just unfair circumstances that happen to them. I can tell you, after 4 years of living here, 4 decades of living here on earth, I've learned the one thing you cannot avoid, and that's life has challenges, and you gotta navigate them. These challenges can be enough for some people to want to give up and cash in their life for just relief. Meanwhile, others turn to drugs, alcohol, sex, and other things to counter this pain and the challenges of life. These temporary fixes, of course, are short-term. Short-term and have short-term relief with it. And you don't feel better and only met with the guilt and shame and sorrows that, of course, lead to more anguish. Is that what God wants from us? Does God the Father want us to have this anguish, to have this pain, the suffering and the cheap fixes, to suffer in silence alone? The Bible gives us answers to God's thinking, one of which he states in Proverbs 12:25, he says, "Anxiety in the heart of man causes depression, but a good word makes it glad." But a good word makes it glad. So where does this good word come from? Does this come from out of the ether that you just hear from the clouds or inside your own head? Where does this good word come from, especially if it's sincere? We know it comes from a place of love and care for other people, outgoing concern for other people, as Mr. Armstrong would talk about. The basis for God's way of life is love for God and, of course, our fellow mankind. We know it's the two great commandments. Even the animal kind has a distinct need for companionship. My cat will get up and want to sit in my lap or sit near me. My dog will come greet me when I walk in the door. And guess what? If that's the only thing you had and you're stranded on an island was you had your pet, you'd be appreciative of their company too. So even animal kind has this need for this companionship. Why did God program us this way? Why did God program us this way with the need for companionship, the desire to have another person share in the joy of our life and the sadnesses that go along with living life too. Because he knew we would need and receive love, need to receive, give that love, so that we could be like and know what God the Father feels, what he needs, and to love him and Jesus Christ have for us. Now, fortunately, human beings also have a very selfish side, don't we? Very fleshly side of us. And we get let down by our friends. We get let down by people who are supposed to care for us. People who we thought wouldn't allow events and experiences to stop us from suffering. And we thought, man, we go through this, they should be offering up kind words and helping us endure, and they weren't there. Where were they? And these hurts can be disappointing. They can be very disappointing and cut us deep to have our friends hurt us. But how do we respond when this happens? Can we gain a better understanding of friendship? And can we become better friends to our brethren and not be a fair-weather friend? So today I'm going to examine friendship using biblical and current examples while also hoping to help us become better friends to each other as part of this. So the title is, Are You a Fair-Weather Friend? Are you a fair-weather friend? So the famous basketball coach Roy Williams gave his final lecture at University of North Carolina. He became famous at the University of Kansas, and they won basketball championships there. He won basketball championships in the Tar Heels. But in a speech to the class of 2002, he talked about three types of friends in his opinion. And Coach Williams is probably, I would venture to guess, probably into his 70s, so he's lived enough life to figure a few things out. He said the first layer of friends, as he called talking about layers of friends, you know. He said the first layer of friends are people who are never completely with you. Kind of surface level friends, acquaintances. But they're still your friend, still kind of fun to hang out with from time to time, but they're never completely with you. But they're not loyal to you either. And we see this in different things. I had a friend who's used to serve in the legislature. And the lobbyists obviously love people who serve in the legislature. That's how you get bills passed and get things done. He said, as soon as you're out of office, these people who you thought you were friends, these lobbyists, stop talking to you and move on to the next elected official right behind you. So sometimes you have friends who are just that, surface level friends. The next layer is they're your friends, but if you don't do what they do, what they want you to do, they're not your friends. They're your friends underneath these specific conditions. If you do these things, we're also your friend. This is a conditional friend, a conditional friend. First two are conditional. And he said the final layer are foxhole buddies is what he'd call them. So we're talking about foxhole in an introductory story today. A guy who went out and rescued his friend and drug him back into the trenches in World War I. These foxhole buddies, these are people who have been with you through the thick and thin and are what you call unconditional friends. I think we can consider God an unconditional friend. So we'll start there today examining those two types of friends, conditional and unconditional. So conditions in life bring people together, we know that. People can be brought together through school, sports teams, clubs, associations, work. Yes, even here at church, these conditions bring people together to start forming bonds, to start getting to know each other and developing those friendships. Many times I can remember making friends with someone at work, enjoying their company. We got along really great at work. They put in their resignation and go to a different job, and hey, we're going to keep in touch. We're going to still be friends. We're still going to hang out because we got along so well at work. And what you find is, as time goes along, you know, you might get lunch with them, you might get a cup of coffee, you might make a phone call to them. And then after a while, a few more years go by, and you realize you haven't talked to this person in probably 2 years. And this is normal. This is what normally happens. The conditions that brought you together were work. You were good friends there, and when those conditions no longer existed, you weren't necessarily the same friends anymore. Now, if things brought you back together, most likely you probably would be friends. And that's part of life. Sometimes things work that way. The real test of your friendship being conditional or conditional is if the person was accused of something that led to their reputation being assailed, would you distance yourself from them? I mean, when things were good, you were glad to be seen with them. They were kind of friendly. Hey, I like this guy. But when things aren't so good, I mean, were you quick to disassociate yourself from that person? To say, I don't think I want to be associated with this person. My reputation might take a hit or two. So believe it or not, we find in the Bible someone who found himself in this exact same situation. Matthew 26. So Matthew 26, we read about a story here. Real life example of someone under certain conditions were glad to be friends with Jesus. And when those conditions weren't met, they were quite disappointed. Matthew 26, verse 69. Now Peter sat outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came to him, saying, "You also were with Jesus of Galilee." But he denied it before them all, saying, "I do not know what you are saying." Jesus, this guy who you know, Son of God. Peter knew this. And so, rubber hit the road and the times got tough. He did not even know who this, what you're saying. Verse 71, and when he had gone out to the gateway, another girl saw him and said to those who were with there, "This fellow also was with Jesus of Nazareth." But again he denied with an oath, "I do not know the man." And very strongly said it. And a little later, those who stood by came up and said to Peter, "Surely you also are one of them, for your speech betrays you." Then he began to curse and swear, saying, "I do not know the man." Immediately a rooster crowed, as Jesus predicted, if you read earlier, said, "You'll deny me three times," and sure enough, he did. And Peter remembered the word of Jesus, who also said to him, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." So he went out and wept bitterly. Peter realized at that moment he was a conditional friend. He had betrayed his friend. In a moment when your friend needed him most, he wasn't there and he recognized it. When Jesus was to be a conquering king, to overthrow the Roman government, throw them out, usher in Israel, slogan was back then, "Make Israel great again." And when that wasn't going to happen, Peter said, "I'm not with this guy. I'm not with this guy." So even this is a problem that we can see that even Jesus suffered from. So when you think, "Oh, I must be unique that, you know, someone betrayed me. This is a unique hurt." And yes, it hurts. Jesus has felt this hurt. So how many times do we distance ourselves from others, from our friends, when our association with the person may cause our own reputation to slip and say, "Hey, doesn't work for me. Does not work. This guy, you know, hey, isn't Joe your friend? I, you know, we've hung out a couple times together. You know, we worked together, whatever. I don't know who the guy is, but man, don't associate me with me right now." Back in 2006, the actor Michael Richards, better known as Kramer on Seinfeld. Everybody know who Kramer on Seinfeld is? You might have even seen a video, some of the videos. Back in 2006, Michael Richards was probably giving admittedly not a good performance. He had said so later on, so his performance on stage as a stand-up comedian wasn't real good. And, you know, people coming in were expected to see Kramer doing his shtick on stage, and it was supposed to be good. But he wasn't being real good. A black audience member began to heckle him and give him a real hard time about it. This led Richards to lose his temper and began assaulting that audience member with a lot of racial slurs. This was recorded. It blew up all over the internet and the media. And Michael Richards took it. He was in a rough place, very rough place. Lots of people were so quick to condemn him and to distance themselves from him. People who probably his friends probably weren't there standing next to him at this particular case. And who can blame them, you might think too, right? I don't want to be associated with this guy. There's one article wrote about this. It said, Michael also showed his appreciation for Jerry Seinfeld for standing by him. It isn't surprising for fans because Jerry was one of the few people who didn't abandon Michael or distance themselves from this Seinfeld star. He told Jerry on the show, "Comedians getting coffee with coffee and cars, he said, "And thanks for sticking by me. It meant a lot to me, but inside it still kicks me around a bit." And if you haven't watched this, it's a pretty good one to watch if you like Seinfeld. Jerry responded and was gracious about it, telling Michael he had no option but to support him during that time. He also told him it was time to stop letting the incident kick him around. He says, "You know, I've been carrying this bag long enough. I'm going to put it down." And that's what he was telling Michael. Put the bag down. Quit carrying this around. Move forward. Jerry went on to cast him in the B-movie the next year. And then he put him in Comedians with Getting Coffee and Cars, where Richards publicly thanked Jerry for standing by him as his friend. Now, Jerry Seinfeld, who back in the 2000s was coming off the end of the show, had lots of fame, very successful. Wouldn't it have been easy for Jerry just to say, "I'm putting myself between him and getting as far away from Michael Richards because I don't want him to lose any of my success right now"? But he didn't. He did the opposite of what most people would do. He stood by his friend and helped him at the moment when he needed it. That's what a good friend does. And that's what Jerry was being at that point. Now back to Peter's denial of Christ. What was Jesus' response when this happened? Like, "Hey, I'm banishing you, Peter. No way. We're done, Peter. You're going to abandon me now? Forget you. We're moving on. We're done, buddy. This isn't the moment. I needed you and you didn't support me." Was that the way he handled it? Did he handle it that way? Well, we know he wasn't. He showed him grace. He showed him mercy. He forgave him. Because Jesus is an unconditional friend. Peter was conditional, but Jesus wasn't. And because of that, Peter later became an unconditional friend of Christ to the point of his own death. So sometimes we do have to endure the betrayal of a friend or hurt of a friend, but stand by him still because you can be an unconditional friend, and hopefully they recognize it, hopefully they see it, and hopefully, in turn, they become an unconditional friend. So what should our response be to a spiritual brothers and sisters when they make a mistake or experience a trial? Do we run, deny, hide like Peter? Or is it silence, do nothing? Don't say anything. Boy, you know, they're going through a tough time. Hopefully they get through it. Or do we speak out? Do we condemn them? Do we gossip about them? Do we slander them? "Boy, did you hear what happened to so-and-so? Boy, I'd like to, oh man, I can't believe that happened." "Yeah, me neither." And you're sitting there saying, "Boy, I should be the friend of this person. I should stop the gossip and slander. I should stand by him. Hey, I know that person. They're a good person. They made a mistake. Forgive them, move forward, move on." Or do we participate in the event, the gossip, slander of that person? And you say, "Well, that doesn't happen in the church." Of course it does. You've been around church long enough, you can see through splits and other problems through church, this has been an issue that's happened. Gossiping and slandering and hurting each other. They're supposed to be your friends, supposed to be your brethren. Or do we stick close to each other, like Jerry Seinfeld did with Michael Richards, and support them and help them overcome the situation and endure the trial? I would certainly hope as Christians we would decide to help them overcome and endure versus participate in the further persecuting of them, hurting them. In the early 2000s, the Yankees were going through a small rebuilding phase. If you follow baseball, you may remember this time. They'd just come off of winning 4 out of 6 World Championships, I think it was, something like that, 4 out of 6 trips to the World Series. But the team was obviously getting older. As sports goes, the shelf life of an athlete isn't long. And the team was getting older, and they needed to kind of replenish the team, reset it, get some new talent, younger talent in, and help them get across the finish line. One of the players that was getting older was the first baseman, Tino Martinez. He was very solid at the plate, very solid first baseman. If you remember him in the 90s, very good baseball player, really part of that Yankees core. He was a strong leader, though. He was also very respected in the clubhouse. Very respected in the clubhouse at the time. But, of course, he was getting older. Not putting up the numbers he did the previous years when they were winning the championships. And the Yankees We're looking at signing a really good young first baseman who previously played with the Oakland A's. He was a free agent, very strong, hit home runs. They're probably going to sign him and not re-sign Tino Martinez. This led to some controversy in New York around the Yankees. Should they be loyal to Tino? Should they hire the young talent? Become more competitive. At the time, Derek Jeter, if you remember, Derek Jeter was fairly young. He's from just south of here in Kalamazoo. And he was multiple-time All-Star. Peak of his career, really. Peak of his career. Had a lot more championships to win. And he could benefit from some young talent on the team. So they went to him. The media went to him and said, hey, Derek, what do you think of this controversy between Tino Martinez and hiring this new free agent? The obvious and safe answer was, well, that's a management thing. Ownership's going to be dealing with that. I don't chime in on ownership issues. That's the safe way to get on that one. Or he could have maybe even said, hey, we need to be winning and do what it takes to win. He didn't say that. What he said was, Tino Martinez is my friend and I stand with him and support him. Because Tino Martinez was his friend. He was there for Derek Jeter when he was a young rookie, getting smacked around a little bit to help him, support him. And Derek Jeter was in turn loyal to Tino Martinez. That stood out to me. It stood out to a lot of people, that matter of fact. Everyone thought, what a great response. I mean, no one saw that one coming. But that's the response we should have in these situations. If someone is your friend, that's the way we should treat people. So in these tough moments, I think of Job also. I think of Job who, I mean, everyone's been through trials, but I don't know if everyone's been through a series of consecutive trials like Job probably went through. Very difficult time. He lost everything, and I mean everything, except for his own life and his wife's life. He lost everything, wealth, animals, family, his own health, everything left him. Very difficult time. But if we look in Job 2, if we turn to Job 2, we can see a response that took place from his friends. Now, at some point, his friends did give him some good advice, but at first, his friends had the right response here. His friends, I thought, really did the right thing. And we'll look at Job 2, verse 11. Job 2, verse 11. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all this adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place. Eliphaz, the Temanite, Bildad, the Shuhite, and Zophar, the Zammonite. For they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. Their response was, they heard about this and said, we need to be there for our friend. Now, some of these people might have been business associates, how they met him and got to know him. And now he can't do anything for him anymore. He's not rich. He's not wealthy. He's not famous. He has no influence. He has no power. He has no authority anymore. Why should I go call on Job? It was not their answer. They wanted to mourn with him and comfort him in his time of need. Verse 12, and when they raised their eyes from afar, they did not recognize him. They lifted their voices and wept, and each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head towards heaven. So they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw his great grief. They saw that his grief was very great. To the point that they saw their friend, remembering what their friend looked like, remembered what his house looked like, remembered how pristine his farm probably looked like, and to walk up to see everything destroyed, to see their friend just in horrible physical shape, cut them to the core because of their love for their friend. Cut them to the core. Too often we try to solve the problem for our friends, and I can tell you this, I suffer from that too. I hear about a problem, I want to go try to solve the problem for them. Sometimes you can't solve the problem. Sometimes you just need to be there for the friend. Sometimes you just have to help out. Use your positive energy to support them through the crisis. Something to think about. Something to think about in this little bit when you're examining this topic of friendship. In order to be a good and loyal friend, you don't have to necessarily agree with the mistake the person made in order to support them or the situation they're in right at that moment. Whatever's going on, you don't have to agree with it. You just have to be there for them. God supports us even when we make egregious mistakes. You think about how many times we've sinned and we continue to do it. We go through Passover, we go through Atonement, all these times we're supposed to clean up our act, get ourselves in better shape and move forward, and we go back to the causing problems in our life, committing the same sins, having the same issues. And God continuously is loyal to us, forgives us, and helps us in these moments. Too often when someone who is a friend makes a mistake, we'll treat them like an associate and quickly distance ourselves and not to tarnish our good name too, as we've talked about. At the cost of that person's peace of mind, the need for companionship like Job. The moment it should have been so easy to turn their back on Job, but they didn't. They didn't disavow their relationship with him. They held their relationship with him. And I can tell you, at times in my life, I've had some controversial situations. And when I've looked around the situation, I found, why? Where did all those people who were my friends a little bit ago go? Some of you may have gone through those situations too where you thought, man, what happened to my friends? A lot of times people go through divorce and find out, well, you know, they all took one side or the other, and that can be very hurtful too. Went through the church split in 95. I remember when everyone was taking sides in that time. And I was just old enough, I was my son's age, when that happened. And all these people who were my friends, gone. And people had chose sides and went their own ways. That was a hurtful time. And I know many of you went through that too. Many people were, you hoped were your friends, but they weren't there. And that went both ways, I'm sure. And there's some people that I remember we still hung out with afterwards. It was that unconditional friendship that, you know, hey, look, we became friends. We disagree on some things, but we're going to stay together. Not enough of that happened, obviously. Hebrews 13:3 says, remember the prisoners as if chained with them, those who are mistreated, since you yourselves are also in the body. Matthew 25, let's turn there, Matthew 25. Matthew 25, 34. We'll read through 40. Then the king will come, will say to those on his right hand, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did you see a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did you see you sick or in a prison and come to you? And the king will surely answer and say to them, surely I say to you, inasmuch as you did to one of these, of the least of these, my brethren, you did it to me. So you see here, when times are not good, that's the time we're also supposed to be friends. In as much as prison, in as much as someone who is in prison, still supposed to be friends with them. And the funny thing is, the word here doesn't say that they were innocent and put in jail. It doesn't say they're, unjustly accused of a crime, falsely accused of a crime. It says they're in prison. It just says that. We can add some color to it and think, well, maybe it's persecuted for the faith or whatever. But maybe they're just in prison, too, for something maybe they committed. Maybe they're guilty of it. But it doesn't say not to visit them if they're guilty. It says to continue visiting them, to support them. There's many years ago, a church member actually murdered her young daughter. Absolutely tragic, and it was a sad situation. And some of you may have heard about it in other parts of the country at the time. I think it was in the late 70s or something along that it took place. You know, what can move a person to commit such a heinous act against their own child? I can't fathom in my own head to get to that point, but this person obviously was under the influence of evil, succumbed to it, had worked it in her mind for a while, and murdered her young daughter, who was, I think, under the age of 10 at the time. However, out of compassion, love, and understanding, that person, who had many friends in the church before that incident, and you can bet a lot of them forgot the name of that woman and when she went to prison for killing her daughter. But there were some people, when my parents came into church in the 80s, learned that they were still visiting her in prison after that. Still visiting her, keeping friendship with this person. And that must have been tough at first to go do it, to go see that person face to face, and a person who obviously committed a heinous act. But their compassion and knowing that they're under the influence of evil, and that maybe someday they'd be cleared of that burden of evil that was in their mind. But that's a tough thing, because my guess is a lot of people in that congregation probably never did go visit her. And even if she repented of that act and hoped to one day be a part of God's family, maybe that changed things. But that was it's a tough thing. But when we look at this topic a bit more, we start getting into, you know, what exactly is this? You know, we look at camaraderie. The word camaraderie came to mind to me. Camaraderie and brotherhood were two words that came to me. And the definition for camaraderie is mutual trust, friendship among people who spend a lot of time together. So here's some things. You build trust and friendship when you spend a lot of time together. So that's the part, you know, and I commend Becky for putting together an English tea, you know, for people to come out and build friendships, build relationships. This is where friendships and relationships come together. We do a camp out every year. You know, people come to that. And I've built some great relationships with the people who go to the camp out. The Beans being among them. And others have come to the camp out. It's part of it. You got to spend time together to build that camaraderie. Because if you don't build the camaraderie, you're not going to have that trust. Some synonyms for it is friendship, comradeship, fellowship. Fellowship. Man, what a word, right? What a word. Companionship, brotherliness, brotherhood, sisterhood, closeness, affinity, togetherness, solidarity, sociability, team spirit, camaraderie, good fellowship, and mutual support are some of the words associated with this topic. So the question we have is, do we exemplify these words? When we look at one of the words, like we said, it's brotherhood that came to mind here. Definition for that is the feeling of kinship. So it's like family. Closer than just someone walking the street, you're like family to me. Closeness to a group or people or of all people. Brethren is the word we use a lot, right? We use brethren. It reminds me of that too. We are brethren. We're family. We're in a kinship here in church. This is the kind of love and care we should have for each other too. Now, question for you. It's camaraderie and brotherhood just for good times? It's easy to be the friends with someone when everything's up, right? I mean, when things are going good, I like to be your friend too. That's easy, right? When everyone and everything's going well, things are on track. No problems here, folks. We're just smiles and giggles. That's easy to be someone's friend. But what about when they're experiencing a trial? Times are really tough. When everyone's left them and it's not cool to be with that person anymore, are you still their friend? And the short answer is yes, we should. We should. There is no day off from being a friend or spiritual brother or sister. That's just part of it. We know of ministers who have went through controversial times that were our friends before, and hopefully we were friends after that too. We weren't just friends with them because of the position they held. Example of this is David and Jonathan. David and Jonathan had a very close relationship to the point where people sometimes pervert it, and it's a shame that people do that. You know, Jonathan stuck by David's side. When Jonathan was a crown prince, all-powerful, had no reason to stick by David's side when he became the black sheep of the palace and Saul was chasing him, he had no reason to support him anymore. But he did. Let's read about that in 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel 20. Then Jonathan said to David, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty. And when you have stayed 3 days, go down quickly and come to the palace, or to the place where you hid in the day of the deed, and remain by the stone of Ezel. Then I will shoot 3 arrows to the side as though I shot at the target. And there I'll send a lad saying, 'Go find the arrows.' If I expressly say to the lad, 'Look, the arrows are on the side of you, get them and come in,' then as the Lord lives, there is safety for you and no harm. But if I say thus to the young man, 'Look, the arrows are beyond you, go your way, for the Lord has sent you.'" Verse 23 of chapter 20. "And as for the matter which you and I have spoken of, indeed, the Lord be between you and me forever." Again, saying, hey, we're together. We're strong through this. And just a little background here, if you go back, you can read some more. Again, like we've said, Saul is going after David. There's obviously a problem here, and Jonathan's with his friend David. Verse 24, "Then David hid in the field, and when the new moon had come, the king sat down to eat the feast. Now the king sat on a seat, as the other times, on a seat by the wall, and Jonathan arose, and Abner sat by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, 'Something has happened to him. He is unclean. Surely he is unclean.'" That's the only reason Saul was thinking. He wasn't sitting at the table with him. Verse 27, "And it happened the next day, the second day of the month, that David's place was empty again. And Saul said to Jonathan, his son, 'Why has the son of Jesse not come to eat either yesterday or today?'" Finally wanted some answers. Why is he not here? So Jonathan answered Saul, "David earnestly asked permission of me to go to Bethlehem. And he said, 'Please let me go, for our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. And now, if I found forever in your eyes, please let me get away and see my brothers.' Therefore, he has not come to the king's table." And at this point, Saul's anger was aroused against Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman." Now, we could probably understand what the equivalent of that today would be. You son of a, you know what? That's what he meant. He was not happy. He was using coarse language. He was nasty. He was mean, just as David thought he would be in this situation. This was a test from David to see how nasty and mean is he towards me. He was very. He goes on to say here in 30, "Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness?" And I imagine in that language back then, that was extremely strong language. "For as long as the son of Jesse lives on earth, you shall not be established, your king nor your kingdom. Now therefore send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die." As David suspected, he hated him, wanted him killed. And he was right. Probably as long as David was alive, Jonathan would probably not become king. So he wasn't wrong. And Jonathan knew that, by the way. Jonathan's friendship with David was not about power and authority. It was about their relationship, about the closeness they built by going to battles together, going to war together, hanging out in the palace together. I imagine these two are pretty close in age. Jonathan was very brave. You can see that at times in battles. He was very brave, and so was David. They probably had a lot in common. These guys grew to be very close, working together. Verse 32, "And Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said to him, 'Why should he be killed? What has he done?' Then Saul, the father of Jonathan, cast a spear at him to kill him, by which Jonathan knew it was determined by his father to kill David." He was going to try to kill his own son over the whole thing, too. He was so mad. So Jonathan, at this point, could have just at any point said, "Hey, you know, you're right, I'm out of this whole thing, I'm done. Nope, you're right, David's a bum." He was loyal to David, even to the point where he might have been killed by his own father. Verse 34, "So Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had treated him shamefully. And you're thinking, in front of all of the leadership of Israel, that's pretty much what you have. You have Abner sitting there, David was there, Jonathan's there, Saul's there. This is pretty much a cabinet leadership level meeting. And he just shamed him. He chewed him out in front of everybody, cast a spear, tried to kill him. This was not a good situation, folks. If you can try to get your emotions about what it might have been like to be there, it must have been a very difficult situation to endure. Verse 35, and so it was in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field at the time appointed with David, and a little lad was with him. Then he said to the lad, now run, find the arrows which I shoot. As the lad ran, he shot the arrows beyond him. When the lad had come to the place where the arrow was which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan cried out before the lad and said, is not the arrow beyond you? And if you remember back reading before, that was the plan. If it's, you got to flee for your life, David, this is what I'm going to say. And that's what he had to say there. Verse 38, and Jonathan cried out after the lad, make haste, hurry, do not delay. So Jonathan's lad gathered the arrows and came back to his master. But the lad did not know anything. Only Jonathan and David knew of the matter. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to his lad and said to him, go, carry them to the city. And said, hey, just go on now. I'll just stay out here by myself for a little bit. As soon as the lad had gone, David arose from the place towards the south and fell on his face to the ground. And bowed down three times and kissed, and they kissed one another and they wept together, but David more so. At this point, if you can get the emotions of the situation, close friends realizing that their friendship is not ever going to be the same again. This was an extremely sorrowful moment. What they had known before was never to be again. And they might never see each other again after this. And for all Jonathan knew, they might eventually catch David and kill him. What a horrible experience for two young men to go through. So when we read these things and the people who pervert it, oh, they kissed one another and all these things, or he loved him like himself or whatever, it's because if you had a close friend ever who you really loved, you don't pervert it that way. You understand that you care about him. Verse 42, then Jonathan said to David, go in peace, since we've both just sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, may the Lord be between you and me, and between your descendants, and my descendants forever. So he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. And we do know eventually David upheld his covenant with him. And he found out that Jonathan had kids, had a son. And he brought him back and restored him back to his level. So the friendship was not just talk, it was action. So I had a friend, my friend Roger, actually. Roger is my friend back in junior high. I would transfer schools, and Roger was one of the few guys I was able to make friends with. And we hit it off. Roger's been one of these guys. I remember one time I was teenager, my car ran out of gas, and just happened to be Roger, just happened to driving by at the same time, stopped, picked me up, and went and got gas for my car. And just always been the guy that when, you know, some of the more tough or difficult moments in my life happened, just for whatever reason, he was there when I needed him. You know, God was able to put him in my life at those times, and he was always been a good friend. We've had our moments where our friendship was tested. But overall, over the years, have been good friends with each other. He sent me this video and said, hey, you know, thanks for being a friend. In his five areas of friendship, this guy is a Marine. I think it looks like he's also in some type of martial arts dojo, and he's talking to some young students. He says, you need these five friends in your life. He said, five friends. And so I thought, hey, I think I might work this in, because I was thinking about this message when he sent it to me. He said, the first friend is you need a covenant friend. Now we see what a covenant friend looks like between David and Jonathan, right? That's a covenant friend. Not conditional, unconditional. May it be my head if I ever break this covenant between you and me. That's the kind of friendship that is. Thick and thin, always there for you. Proverbs 17:17. A friend loves at all time, and a brother is born for adversity. It's Proverbs 17:17. Proverbs 27:10. Do not forsake your own friend, or, here's one thing that got me too, or your father's friend. Nor go to your brother's house in the day of calamity. Better is a neighbor nearby than a brother far away. What stood out to me is that your father's friend is your friend too. And thus, if your friend has a son, he's your friend then. And I'm like, wow, that's an interesting way of looking at that, that you have an obligation to be his friend too because he's been a friend to your father. Talking about kinship, we talked about as one of the words, kinship, like family. Number two is a spiritual friend. This is a person, he said, prays for you, then you seek for spiritual advice and support. In Proverbs 27:17 is iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. Sometimes you need a friend to help you, give you advice, to see you through a moment, give you some good wisdom. And that's what a friend does too. A friend is not only just loyal, but it's also a spiritual friend. They pray for you. They help you when you have your spirit's broken. They're there to help you through those moments. There are also Proverbs 27:5. Open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. And yes, an enemy will tell you what you want to hear. And if you're in any position of authority, there's people who will come across as your friend and tell you exactly what you want to hear, and they seem so nice. And if you can see through it, most of the time you can. If you're looking for it, you see through it. But faithful are the wounds of a friend. You'd rather have the wound from a friend telling you, you're a bum right now, you need to get your act together. You'd rather have that than someone tell you nice, sweet things who's your enemy. So just keep that in mind. Sometimes a friend will hurt you intentionally to help you, and sometimes unintentionally, but you'd rather have a friend doing it than an enemy giving you kisses. Number three is a confidant friend. Confidant friend. It's a friend you can share anything with them. Not be judged. They don't judge you. They don't condemn you. Hey, this happened. I'm feeling like a dog right now. And they're there, like Job's friends, sitting with you. All right, man, I understand. I understand how you feel. You're not saying you support them, by the way. You're not saying I support what you did or what happened to you in your life. But you're just there with them. You're there for them, helping them through that tough situation they're in. Proverbs 18:24. A man who has friends must himself be friendly. But there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Closer than a brother. But the funny thing I think about this is if you want to get friends, you also need to be friendly too. That is part of it. You have an obligation too. Number four, a hospitable friend. A hospitable friend. They care for your well-being. Want to know how your mental and physical health's doing. How you doing, man? You taking care of yourself? You been to the doctor recently? I've been noticing you're not doing real well here. Hey, take care of yourself here. They care about your well-being. Proverbs 27:9. Ointment and perfume delight the heart, and the sweetness of a man's friend gives delight by hearty counsel. The sweetness of a friend gives delight by hearty counsel. It is hearty counsel, the help of a friend, making sure you're doing well, caring about your well-being. That's part of it. And then the fifth one he said was a hitman friend. This is a protective friend who wants to protect you. And you can see that Jonathan was also that. He wanted to protect his friend David. The protective friend has your back when the wolves are knocking on your door. We're not going to let them get you this way. They're not taking you down. You're my friend. I have your back. I'm supporting you. Just like the guy who went onto the battlefield to get his friend and drag him back into the foxhole. That's the type of friend you want. Ecclesiastes 4:9. Two are better than one because they had a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion, but woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Verse 12, though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Friends who stick together are stronger together to withstand problems. Strength and friendship. You might have heard, let me just review those five real quick. The first one is a covenant friend. Second is a spiritual friend. Third is a confidant friend. Fourth is a hospitable friend. And the fifth is a hitman friend. Some of you might have heard the song, you find out who your friends are. Tim McGraw, Tracy Lawrence, and Kenny Chesney. Everybody heard that one before? I'd sing it, but, you know, I've been told many times I have a speaking voice, not a singing voice, so I'll spare you the singing of this song, but I'll read it real quick. I think it's kind of good to read here. Starts out, it says, run your car off the side of the road, get stuck in a ditch, way out in the middle of nowhere, get yourself in a bind, lose a shirt off your back, need a floor, need a couch, need a bus fare. This is where the rubber meets the road. This is where the cream is going to rise. This is what you really didn't know. This is where the truth don't lie. And I think of this is a funny one, but I've had a friend call me up and need to sleep on my couch because he got thrown out of his house before. And, you know, hey, come on over, buddy. We got you over here. My wife was quick to say, I hope this doesn't become regular. But I was prepared if he needed to be regular. I was prepared to help him. But it does happen sometimes. Tough times happen. The song goes on. You find out who your friends are. Somebody's going to drop everything, run out and crank up their car, hit the gas, get there fast, never stop to think what's in it for me. Or is it way too far? They just show up with their big old heart. You find out who your friends are. It goes on. Everybody wants to slap your back, wants to shake your hand when you're up on top of the mountain, but let one of those rocks give away when you slide back down, look up and see who's around then. And that's the truth. If you've ever been proverbially at what you thought was the top and you slid back down to the bottom and you looked around, there's not too many people around. This ain't where the road ends, comes to an end. This ain't where the bandwagon stops. This is just one of those times when a lot of folks jump off. You find out who your friends are. Somebody's going to drop everything, run out, crank up their car, hit the gas, get there fast, never stop to think what's in it for me or way too far. They just show up with the big old heart. You find out who your friends are. I remember one time I was trying to fly back from, I think it was Dallas, and all my flights got screwed up. And I called one of my friends from, I used to go to a young man's speech club. This was, you had to be under 30 at the time for this. So I was my way of making some friends, some guys from the other side of the state. And I called one of them up and said, hey, I think I might be able to get a flight into Detroit. Can you think you'd come pick me up? He said, absolutely. Worked out, I didn't have to take him up on it, but it was nice to have a friend you could call up to pick you up from the airport when you needed it. Song goes on, when the water's high, when the weather's not so fair, when the well runs dry, who's going to be there? You find out who your friends are. Somebody's going to drop everything, run out, crank up their car, hit the gas, get there fast, never stop to think what's in it for me, or the way too far. They just show up with their big old heart. You find out who your friends are. You find out who your friends are. So I thought that was good because when I was preparing this at one moment, I actually kind of wrote in one part, you find out who your friends are, and I thought, I got to work that song in. So I think it's appropriate. You know, in Psalms 133, the 133rd Psalm, it says, behold how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. If we are dwelling together in unity, we're friends. We're friends. It's like the precious oil upon the head running down on the beard of Aaron running down on the edge of his garments. It's like the dew of Hermon descending upon the mountains of Zion. For there the Lord commanded the blessings, life forevermore. And we think some of these examples in the Bible of things people do, you'd bow down and kiss someone's feet and do all these kind of things. You think they're so weird. It's because we don't understand the culture. Oil running down on your head and your beard. Today we'd be like, oh, I got oil on me. This is a good thing, you know? I mean, this is a good thing in that time. So friends, dwelling together in unity, it's a good thing. God wants us to dwell in unity. It's part of his design to have good, close friends. He's programmed us with this need for friendship. And even science, the funny thing is when I was looking, doing some research into this, and at some point you just got to cut your notes. But even science has proven that when you have good friends, your health scores are empirically better. Your numbers are better. Your cancer treatments are better. Your blood pressure is better. Everything checks out better when you have people who have friends with it versus don't. Absolutely blew me away. But scientifically, they've proven this, that people who have friends have better health scores. So when we're friends with each other, our health is better too. His word clearly states his children are to dwell together in harmony, become close, and support each other in this life. We need to examine ourselves too. We need to examine ourselves. Zach Morris, the guy talking right now, needs to examine himself to figure out what kind of friends he is. I started thinking, you know, times I've seen, you know, Frank Kelly go through some tough challenges here in this room. Did I call him? I don't think I did. And I think, you know, that's on me. That's on me. It's on all of us to examine ourselves sometimes when we should have been better friends with each other. And those are things we got to get better. I got to get better at, and I hope I will become better at these things. But if we look externally for things to change, well, when he's a better friend, I'll be a better friend. That's never going to happen, folks. You know that. But if all of us commit together to become better friends, unconditional friends, guess what's going to happen? We're all going to rise up together. Everything's going to get better. That's just part of it. I'll leave you this one question as we finish here. What kind of friend are you?